There's the snap. Marshall back, looking in the pocket. Going to go deep down the field, and that ball will be, oh my God, tipped and caught. Touchdown, Auburn. Holy smokes, I don't believe it. We tipped it. We had three guys that tipped it. They had a man running in stride and caught the tip for a touchdown, but there's flags back on the field.
That's going to be on us to take it off our helmets just in disbelief.
Here's your ball game. Nick Marshall stands in, steps up. He's going to throw downfield, just a home run ball, and it is tipped off. And Lewis going on the deflection. Lewis is going to score. Lewis is going to score. Lewis is going to score. Touchdown, Auburn. Touchdown, Auburn. A miracle in Jordan Hare. A miracle in Jordan Hare. 73 yards, and the Tigers, with 25 seconds to go, lead 43-38.
You're listening to the AU Wishbone, almost credible sports discussion on the White Rocket Entertainment Network.
Bye-bye, Bo! Touchdown, Auburn!
The kick is good! Auburn wins! Shivers just ran through a man! Touchdown,
Hello and welcome to the AU Wishbone, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, along with all of our great supporters via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and we have another special episode this week. John is super busy dealing with all the stuff up in Virginia to do with the coronavirus, and so we're trying to give him a little time to deal with that and to get our next show ready to go on a week from today. So meanwhile, we're going to do another flashback, and I was digging around through the archives of our oldest shows when we first got started, and of course, we don't want to listen to anything from 2012, but you know, a few weeks ago, we did the 2013 Texas A&M game, so I thought this might be a darn fine time to hear the Georgia game from that year, and I really enjoyed it. I went back and listened to it just to kind of get a sense of whether it was appropriate, and in the first half of it, we talk about the game itself, and the second half, we do some really interesting, I think, speculation on where that put Auburn at that point in the 2013 season, what would happen when we played Alabama, where we might go in the postseason, would we go to the Sugar Bowl, right? Because we weren't entirely convinced we were going to beat Georgia and Alabama that year. That was really, we thought, you know, kind of reaching. And so we do a lot of speculation. And there's some other kind of fun stuff along the way, too. So without further ado, I present to you the 2013 Georgia game, which at that time we hadn't decided, were we going to call it the Immaculate Deflection or were we going to call it the Prayer in Jordan Hare. But in any case, it's the 2013 Auburn-Georgia game. Enjoy!
I'm John Ringer, and I'm joined as always by my co-host.
I'm Van Plexico.
And Van, there are insane roller coaster designers out there who once designed something along the lines of the Auburn-Georgia game from last Saturday, and they were laughed out of the room because they said it was impossible and human beings couldn't possibly take it. They all have a heart attack.
That's about the truth.
So how would you respond to that, and how are you feeling days later about that game?
I tell you, I think that that game was so intense that it gave me the flu.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
I was actually hoarse immediately after the play.
A miracle in Jordan Hare! A miracle in Jordan Hare!
We're going to walk through it in a minute, but I got to say this part. My wife was at a birth, had taken our little girl to a birthday party, and I was texting her minute by minute updates, and she comes back and says, my phone is at 3%. And I'm like, oh crap. Cause this was with like 4 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. And then she's like 1%, and her phone died. The last thing she got was Georgia on the Auburn 5 yard line, fourth and goal.
Oh my God!
That's just cruel.
Yes. So when she came in the door, she's like, did they score? And I said, yes. And she's like, oh. And I said, come sit down. I will rewind. So she got to see it. But I was very hoarse at that point, and I only got worse overnight. And when I got up Sunday, I was pretty bad. And by Monday, I had full-blown bronchitis, flu, whatever you want to call it. And only this morning have I been feeling the least bit better and able to participate. So I just want to apologize to all of our listeners, and we appreciate every one of you for me delaying things of all weeks, right? Of all weeks to have this happen. Believe me, I was hating it. I really wanted to talk about it.
We were fired up to talk about it on Sunday and Monday.
Yeah, we had the outline all done and everything. And then here I go, unable to, I couldn't barely even talk. I mean, I'm sure I don't sound very good right now. I've been working all day teaching classes and having to talk there too. So this is what's left of a day of work after getting over the thing. So we're going to let John kind of run the point tonight, which is kind of neat for a number of reasons. It left me literally a physical wreck.
All right. Well, what did you think when that specific one play happened? What was the thought process that went through your head?
Oh, goody. I've been wanting to talk about this. Yeah. All right. Well, as you and doubtlessly every other Auburn fan and honestly probably a lot of Georgia fans too know, I timed it, and it actually took 45 minutes for that pass play to go from Nick Marshall's hand and ultimately into the end zone. It took about 45 minutes, right?
It seemed like it.
I was going to walk through the thought process really quickly. Here's how it seemed to me. Okay, Marshall's going to throw it. Oh, Lord, just throw the short, safe, 20-yard pass. Oh, he's chucking it. Oh, my goodness. He must see somebody wide open. Oh, no. Oh, there's three Georgia guys who have a better shot at it than Ricardo Lewis. Oh, what a disaster. Here it comes down. I wonder if they're going to intercept it and run it back for a touchdown and make this look like a worse score than it already is. Wait, no, they're banging into each other. The ball seems to be going up in the air. Oh, that's kind of funny. So it's going to end on an incomplete pass. Wait, it's bouncing straight toward Ricardo Lewis, who is inexplicably 3 yards off to the side from the path of the ball, which we can get to later. Because I don't know what Ricardo Lewis was looking at or thinking, but he was not in a straight line with the ball. I have a lot to say about that later. But anyway, so now I'm thinking, oh, look, the ball is bouncing kind of in his direction. Well, we've seen this happen a million times. And what always happens is the ball goes over their head, bounces off their helmet, bounces off their shoulder, maybe bounces off one hand and hits the ground. Isn't this disappointing that it's actually going to hit him in the hands before he drops it? Wait, look. Oh, he's going to juggle it before he drops it. Well, that's even more salt in the wounds. Great. Look at Ricardo Lewis. He's hanging on. At this point, I began screaming, oh, my God, over and over and over. Other language followed that I can't really give out here. About 2 minutes later, my wife's brother, my brother-in-law, called on my cell phone while I'm still screaming. I answered the phone, continued screaming, and then hung up. So he got the gist of it. In other words, I went through about 17 different emotions in the 45 minutes, which was actually probably about, 5 seconds at that, that it played out. How did it play out for you? Tell me that.
It was in that same direction. I mean, you know, the fact that it was 4th and 18.
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't feel so bad when we started that drive because we only needed a field goal. Mm-hmm. We had some time. I had some confidence in Marshall, even if he hadn't been great in the fourth quarter. And those three plays before that weren't very good.
Yeah.
And Georgia was all expecting passes and stuff. And then the 4th and 18, to throw it, you know, 50 yards down the field instead of 25 yards down the field, mm-hmm. that was just crazy. Mm-hmm. And then you see the Georgia players there and you're thinking, this is it. They're going to knock it down and the game's over. And then, like you said, Lewis was not really in the right position, but he caught the ball and he's in the end zone. And then we're all screaming and jumping up and down. So,
yeah, if he had been anywhere in the right place to catch the ball, he wouldn't have caught it.
He might have jumped up with the Georgia guys too, is the other thing.
But I don't think he was as tall as them.
But it didn't matter. I mean, the idea is go make a play on the ball, so he could have jumped up there and tried to jump ball with him.
This is something that I really want to get into with you. I'll throw it out now. Maybe we can revisit later. Is for all the talk about the heroic effort of Marshall to throw that ball and the heroic effort of him to go down there and get it and make a play, honest to goodness, neither one of them individually made a play. I mean, let's be honest here. You can hate me, people, if you want to. It was the Auburn quarterback threw about the least safe option that he had. And the Auburn receiver was completely out of position, even if the – let me put it this way. If there had been nobody on the field but Nick Marshall and Ricardo Lewis, I'm not sure Lewis would have caught the ball.
He would not have.
If it had just been the two of them at practice, it would have landed three yards behind his left shoulder.
Yes.
So I've come to the conclusion the only logical and reasonable answer is that it was so insane that it deflected the space-time continuum around them like that spaceship in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where like a tuna fish randomly appears or something.
The improbability field generator.
An improbability field was created on the field. And, you know, an infinite number of things could have happened, one of which was a tuna sandwich land in his hands.
Well, here's the other one that nobody has even talked about yet. Mm-hmm. There were three Georgia guys there.
Yeah.
Okay. Two of them went for the ball.
Right.
The other one was that Corey Moore guy who for some reason stopped.
He just stopped to watch the interception.
Ricardo Lewis kept running.
Yes, that's
true. If Corey Moore had kept running, he either knocked Ricardo Lewis when he was trying to catch the ball or tackled him before he got to the end zone.
Yeah. Yeah, there was about two steps between him actually securing the ball and getting into the end zone. So I'm not sure he would have tackled him. But you're absolutely right. He could have knocked it away, yes.
Right. If Moore was running full speed, he would have been right there with Ricardo Lewis and hit him when he was flipping the ball around in his hands.
But here's the key though, John. Here's the key. The Georgia, which one is it that stopped?
Moore.
Okay. Moore was doing the rational, logical, reasonable thing, which is saying this is going to be intercepted. I'm going to stand here and watch. Ricardo Lewis was so completely oblivious to everything that he kept going. It's one of these things where it was such a bad play by Ricardo Lewis that it worked out. If he had been remotely competent on that play, it wouldn't have worked.
Well, I mean, what was he going to do?
He would have slowed down, turned around, looked back for the ball, done something besides just keep running for the end zone as if it's going to appear magically over his shoulders in his hands, which it did.
It was impressive to catch the ball when that happened.
Let me put it this way. We're recording this on Thursday night, okay? It happened on Saturday. This is Thursday. I spent the first 48 hours in kind of a blissful golden haze, right? But honestly, I've had a little time to reflect on it, and I've been watching it like the Zapruder film over and over. I keep looking for the sniper in the grassy little thing next to Aubie.
No.
The floral arrangement, right?
Sure.
Who shoots the three Georgia guys and lets the ball, or something and deflects it. Maybe, again, it was the hand of God. It's funny. I called it the hand of God on Twitter right after it happened. I said, this is like, Diego Maradona for Argentina in that famous game with England. If you don't know soccer, there was this great classic moment that's actually infamous. It's really bad, where the greatest soccer player next to Pele of all time, Maradona, he's short. And he scored a goal on England by reaching up with his fist and punching the ball in. But the angle he was at to the referee, it looked like it was his head. And so when the reporters asked him after they'd won that game to go to the World Cup final, did you punch it? Was that your hand? And he says, no, that was the hand of God. And I'm like, this was the hand of God reaching down. And sure enough, somebody's put a picture, which I just posted on Facebook. I need to put it on our Wishbone Facebook page, of the Sistine Chapel. Mm. And there's God reaching down and tapping the football into Ricardo Lewis's waiting hands. So it is, and we're going to talk about what we call it in a little bit, because I know there's a couple of questions about that, so I'll hold off. But that touches into what I'm calling it, because there's so many names floating around.
All right, let me ask you this question. We've seen a lot of games of Jordan Hare over the years. What's, in your historical context, a comparable game to this? Maybe not in terms of the finish, because that's tough to top, but just in terms of the nature of the game, the stakes, the back and forth, the level of play, what game would you compare it to?
Well, it's so unique in that we ran out to a huge lead for over three quarters with 9 minutes to go, basically. It was still 37-17.
Oh, my God!
That's just astonishing. But I've watched it like three times now.
And its score never changes?
No, I've had nothing else to do the last 3 days. You know, I mean, there's games that are similar in being wild and woolly, improbable finishes. Jim Fife, you know, falls out of his chair or something. But in terms of just like one play that makes you lose your mind, I mean, you know, the ones that are even close would be like 94 Florida State where Nix hit Sanders in the end zone. That one made me fall down in Ben Hill Griffin Stadium and just like have a conniption fit on the stands. But even still, that was after a methodical drive. It wasn't that surprising. It wasn't just like miraculous. It was just competence. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It was like I was so happy we'd done it, but it wasn't, I can't believe I just saw that. There have been wild and woolly games like that were high scoring. Like I always say, the 2010 Arkansas game still. I mean, because that was a game where at any moment we could have lost, and yet we pulled away at the end.
Well, and there were huge swings back and forth in that game.
Yes. Yeah.
It made me think of this game because there were huge swings.
Yes.
You know, back and forth of momentum and everything else, and big, huge plays, and then the other team would go on a run and do a bunch of stuff.
Well, and the game that I always compared that one to was the 85 Florida State. Because that's the one where it was like 7-7, 14-14, 21-21, 28-28, and then all of a sudden, Bo ran for like 280-yard touchdowns, and they fumbled, and we ran it in, and we won 59-27 or something. So, but yeah, what comes to your mind as far as like just one big? Is it the 2005 Georgia? That was a fourth down bomb, basically. Although what?
Yeah, the Obamanu play, but I mean. The fumble into the end zone we recovered.
Mm-hmm.
The other game it always makes me – this made really made me think of was the 1996 Georgia game.
Oh, God.
Where we lost.
Yes.
It was the first overtime game in SEC history. It was a four-overtime game. And if you didn't watch that game as an Auburn fan, then you're lucky because that was agony.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like a seven-hour marathon of excruciating football. And Auburn had no business losing that game.
Was that the one where we led by like three touchdowns late?
I think so. And I think we blew the lead. And then there was some play at one point in the game, like we were trying to kick a field goal and we didn't have a timeout. And the Georgia players were like laying on top of the Auburn players.
Now,
and didn't get up.
There's been a lot of Georgia games like that. But hold on. Now, here's the thing. Now, there's going to be people listening to this and screaming that we don't know what we're thinking. We're getting confused. All right. There's the 94 and there's 96. 94 is the one where Georgia came back and tied us at the end, and then we missed the field goal, Matt Hawkins, at the end.
That's right.
That was the end of our 20-game streak.
Yeah.
Okay, 96.
I'm thinking about 96.
I know.
Was overtime.
96 was overtime, and that's what I'm saying. I think, and I may be wrong, but I think, and not because these two kind of run together, but because I was at both of these. 96 is the one I want to say that they scored a couple of times to come back. We were way ahead. And they scored a couple of times late to come back, and we were still ahead, and they got down to our end, and we, like, sacked their quarterback.
Is it Zaire or?
Zaire or Bobo. Bobo was in 97, so I'm not sure if he was there in 96 or if it was still. It was one of them. But anyway, we sacked their quarterback, and they don't have a timeout. And the clock is running, and they can't stop the clock. And then one of our linemen goes over and picks up the ball. Mm-hmm. And when he did it, the referee blew the whistle to stop the clock to reset the ball. And when they reset the ball, Georgia was able to get a playoff and scored a touchdown and sent us to overtime.
Yes.
And then in overtime, we each scored. And then in like triple overtime, they scored and then they stopped Damian Craig.
That was the fourth overtime.
Yeah. This was before they put the rule in about having to go for two on the third. Mm. Yeah. It was the first SEC overtime game, and it was like, what, 56-49 or something?
Yeah, it was awful.
It didn't help that was like an ESPN2 7 p.m. game.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that one is similar in the sense that we should have won. We gave up a bunch of points at the very end, and somehow, you know, but that time we didn't win. This time we had the miracle. So, yeah, I think it really does stand to some degree alone, huh?
I think so, too.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for some listener questions?
Yeah.
Well, we'd like to thank everybody again who sent in questions this week. If you're interested in asking us questions anytime, don't have to wait till we ask for them. You could send your questions on Twitter to @AUWishbone, and we'll be happy to answer them on the show. Our first question tonight comes from Josh, which is @TheBlipster, and he asks kind of a literary question. In Gus's epic saga, was the Georgia game the revenge against their main protagonist and a win against Bama the part where we saved the world?
Well, any win against Bama is helping to save the world just a little bit.
You got that right.
And I don't know that UGA is our main, I'm going to say, antagonist. We're the protagonists in our own story. I say that a win against Georgia is revenge against a secondary character. And now the main antagonist comes up in about, what, 9 days?
Yes.
As we record now.
All right. Next question comes from Earl, who's @TheProwler01. He says, what do you name this win or the play? Mm-hmm. We have another question like this, too. Mm-hmm. What we name it. And
yeah,
what's your favorite name?
Yeah, Ross Hatcher asked that question, too. That's why.
And you've seen the prayer, Jordan Hare, the Immaculate Deflection. I liked somebody said today, Deus Ex Ricardo. I really like that.
Good. I hadn't heard that one.
So I don't know. What do you think?
I like the person that said on one of the columns that said Ricardo Lewis and says, that can't be a real name. That's made up, right? Just sounds like a made up name. No, I absolutely like the Immaculate Deflection. That's what I've been calling it. I mean, the prayer in Jordan Hare is okay. It's a little too Bon Jovi for me, but yeah, the Immaculate Deflection, because that's got a good football pedigree. It sounds good. Mm-hmm. It's funny. Yeah, that's the one I'm going with.
It was also immaculate. I mean, just
that's what I say. I wanted to just again make sure everybody understands. I'm not trying to be negative about it. Good gosh, man, I lost my voice for days over it. I mean, I couldn't be more ecstatic about it. I'm just saying, let's just ease up a little bit on talking about that one play in great football terms, because in terms of saying it's a great football play, it's like saying that a hurricane coming through a slum is really clever urban planning. Mm. It's an act of God, and you take it for what it is and be happy, but you don't celebrate your genius when God sends a hurricane through. Okay, I mean, let's just. It was what it was,
and you lost me on the analogy there. But I know what you're saying.
I thought that was a good one. All right, fine.
Next question comes from RC, and he asks, "Do you think Rob Bramlett's miracle call will finally get him out of the shadow of the Great Jim Fife?"
Well, yeah, I think a long time ago he got out of the shadow of the Great Jim Fife. There's been a couple of things. I thought Rod has really done a good job of basically embracing the Fife rather than trying to be different. You know, for a couple of years he tried to be different, and now he just says touchdown Auburn, and I'm like, that's what we want to hear. Thank you. But I think he got out of that shadow a long time ago. What the quote-unquote problem for Rod is all the games are on TV now. You know, in Fife's day, there were still a lot of games that you had to listen to on the radio. And then, of course, there was the probation year, which helped Jim, too, in 93, where you had to listen to, if you weren't there, you know. And so
I want Auburn fans, younger Auburn fans, to think about this for a minute. Imagine the 2003 season is happening and none of the games are on TV.
2013, you mean?
Imagine this. Yeah, this current season is happening. Right. This year's team is having all the success and all these crazy things are happening and all these exciting games, and none of them are on TV. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you could do is try and get it on the radio.
Mm-hmm. That was 1993.
Yeah, and that was us.
And kids, if you want to get the full 1993 effect, A, like John said, they're only on the radio unless you happen to be in the stadium. And B, oh, you don't get to go to Atlanta no matter what happens, and you don't get to be in a bowl no matter what happens. Yeah, 1993 is the definition in the dictionary of bittersweet. There's a picture of the 93 Auburn Tigers under bittersweet.
It's the truth. All right, next question comes from Walt Whittle, who asks, if Auburn doesn't pull off the win at the end against UGA, would you have considered Auburn's season ruined?
No. The only way this season was going to be ruined is if we went 5-7. And even then, I might have been. It would have depended on how the five came out.
Well, but I mean, at this point, there's no way this season – before the Georgia game ever started, this season could not be ruined.
Right, right.
This team has exceeded expectations. They've done an amazing job, and Gus and his staff have got them on the right track. And regardless what happened in the Auburn and in the Georgia and Alabama games, this season could not be ruined.
We have been eating out of the dessert portion of the menu since, like, Ole Miss, right?
Well, I mean, maybe since – certainly, Arkansas. You know, like Arkansas,
yeah,
winning both those games after the old Texas A&M and Ole Miss. No, we're like eating dessert and gravy together at this point. I don't know. So just enjoy the ride. You know,
pretend that's appetizing and go with
that's
it.
That's right. You cannot. There's no way the season could be ruined.
No.
I mean, this team is a miracle. Okay, we took them off the trash pile and one of the best teams in America and. They should put up a freak, regardless what happens against Alabama. You know, people should remember this team forever.
I'm so glad you said that because I want to point out there's no doubt that Gus Malzahn should win the Coach of the Year award.
Yes.
There's no doubt. And it's the Bear Bryant Coach of the Year award. And you know the great, great thing for Auburn fans about the Bear Bryant Coach of the Year award, especially if Gus wins it this year? If Gus wins the Bear Bryant award this year, every Auburn head coach since they invented the Bear Bryant Award will have won it. How awesome is that?
I like it.
Terry Bowden, Tommy Tuberville, Gene Chizik, and then Gus Malzahn. We will have 4 out of 4 Bear Bryant statues in the athletic department offices if he wins it. I just think that is just not only appropriate, but hilarious.
That's good. All right, we got another question here from two different listeners. It's from both Patrick Ringer and from Eric, who's at War Gas Eagle. And it's basically they're asking, what happened in the fourth quarter?
Yes.
You know,
yeah, I've been asking myself that for days.
How did we get there? What did Georgia do to turn it around? And what did Auburn do that made it so bad? And why couldn't we stop it?
Well, let's walk through it. Now, that's the thing. And that's why this game really is kind of bittersweet in a way, too. I mean, we can celebrate the most miraculous play in, to some degree, in Auburn history, this most miraculous single play. But also, there's like this epic collapse that, if not for the miracle, would have made us all sick to death for forever.
That's right.
Utterly demoralizing. So I tried to sort of walk through the last several offensive plays that we had. And John, I have come to the conclusion that it wasn't so much an epic collapse. Well, it amounted to an epic collapse. I understand that. The cumulative effect was, but it was more of a death by a thousand little cuts than one big slice, okay? And here's what I mean by that. It's not that suddenly we just couldn't do anything. It's that a bunch of little things started going wrong, but it was a different little thing every time. And I honestly feel like we were as unlucky on those last two or three drives with our offense as we were lucky on that one play. It's almost like all the good karma that we should have had in the final three drives went away, but then it all came roaring back on one play, you see.
Well, and not just on – you're thinking about just on the offense.
Yeah.
It's the same on the defense.
Right, right.
I mean, there were a million little things that went wrong, penalties.
Mm-hmm.
And we had more penalties in the fourth quarter than we had a lot of other games.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Drove us – and several of them extended Georgia drives that led to touchdowns. So those are the ones that drive you completely bananas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was those kind of mistakes combined with – you know, not getting pressure in the quarterback, pass coverage, and then the offense not doing anything that led to the comeback.
Yeah, I broke it down, and I have it written down somewhere, but I don't have it in front of me. But basically what happened on our last several offensive drives where we went three and out, then we had like a 6 and out or whatever, basically, it really amounted to things like, like a pass where the guy drops it, then the pass is like a yard behind the receiver. There's the epic disaster fail of the collision. That is a play, okay? The jet sweep collision. I had been asking myself for literally years, how come they never run into each other on that play? And they never do. And I started thinking, well, I guess there's no way it can happen for some reason. And then boom, at the most critical moment that it could have happened for our offense, pretty much, it happened. And, that was like the snowball right there, because that was 3rd and 3 when we had the collision. If Trey had gotten 3 or 4 yards on that play, it would have been a new set of downs. The clock would have been running. The run would be working. We could go on a long drive and run the clock out. But what happened was once that happened, and when we got the ball back again, we had to pass. We felt like, right? We get behind the eight ball. We're having to pass. The pass is not working for more separate individual little reasons. And so,
well, but this is where things get questionable to me.
Okay.
That one series after that, we got the ball back with 5:52 left in the game.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And at this point, Auburn is up by 6 points. And so there's less than 6 minutes left. We have a 6-point lead. We had the ball at our own 19-yard line. We threw 3 straight passes.
Mm-hmm.
Incomplete, sack.
Yeah.
And to me, and maybe Georgia, you know, I know Georgia was really daring us to throw the ball. And one of those passes was the slant to Coates where he was open and Marshall missed him. And if he'd have hit him, it had been a first down. And Georgia might not have ever gotten the ball
right
in the game.
Right.
But we had to, I mean, it's 6 minutes left. We're up by 6. I really felt like we had to run some clock here.
Yeah. Well, that's what we had tried to do on the previous possession, and it would have worked if not for the stupid collision play.
Right. So my thing is, don't come back and call 3 pass plays.
Well,
that one sequence really bothered me because we had the ball for less than between first down and third down. It was like 20 seconds
yeah.
we had the ball.
Well,
and that's not good for that point in the game. And that's
no, I agree. But do you feel like if you feel like you're going to come out on first down and they're going to jam up against the run and you try the pass, okay, you think we got the pass, it's there, let's take it, and something happens that it doesn't work, well, now, like I say, you're kind of behind the eight ball. It's 2nd and 10, and if you're grinding out 3 or 4 yards a rush, you really don't want to be running on 2nd and 10.
But I do because the clock's running then. Every time we run the ball, we're taking 45 seconds away out of the game.
Yeah, it's tough. No, so, I understand. I kind of understand what Gus and Rhett were doing. I get it.
I mean, Georgia was daring to do it. The play was there.
Yeah.
This is, again, on both sides of the ball, it was about execution. And in the first half, the execution was awesome.
Yes.
It was on both sides of the ball. It was at a very high level. In the fourth quarter, the execution was terrible.
That's it.
On both sides of the ball, guys didn't follow. And some of it was, you know, maybe they got a little tight. I really think when Georgia started coming back, you know, they started, you know, I think Auburn loosened up a little bit. They started thinking ahead, like, hey, we got this in the bag a little bit. And then also, Georgia's really good. And Murray's really good, and they got hot. They got into a rhythm, and that was a problem for us. And he was throwing the ball out quick. We couldn't get pressure on him. He got comfortable. And then we didn't do anything on offense to respond, to, you know, control the ball, keep it away from him. And I think that Auburn players on both sides of the ball started getting really tight at that point.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, you know me well enough to know by now, obviously, that one of my least favorite components of an offense in football is the drop back, survey the field passing game.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it because it's just too easy to get sacked or throw an interception. And I just don't, unless you have an NFL quarterback and really good receivers, that offense just never seems to work very well. Petrino can coach it. That's about it. So that used to be less than about 20% of Gus's offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this season it's become like 40 or 50%. It's our entire passing game. We're not doing really screens. Where are the bubble screens, the slip screens, the center tunnel screens, all the stuff that we've done in the past, you mm-hmm. know, getting the ball to players like Fannin or whoever in the past or McCaleb. I mean, I just feel like we really don't make any effort to except for the out in the flat. You know, the perfectly horizontal, mm. and we're going to talk more about that in a minute because there's a new play that we're doing. But I don't know. I just am not thrilled with the make him drop back and look all around style of play. But, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it gets a sack, and it, I don't know. So
I understand. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. Just quickly, a couple of my survey questions I want to throw out there. I had asked, aside from Alabama, which SEC team do Auburn fans enjoy beating the most? And it's funny. I want to see what you think about this. The two that came up the most were Georgia and LSU. Now, that tells me that's lately, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you and I would still include maybe Florida or even Tennessee on that list, I think. I mean, LSU lately, but I don't know. I mean, would you rank – do you prefer beating LSU to beating like – is it because of the division? Do you know what I mean? In other words, we get more benefit for beating LSU.
Sure, but I like beating Florida.
Though. I do love beating Florida. There's just a lot of bad blood. There's a seven-year streak in there that has to be redressed. I also asked which non-SEC team people liked, and this is another one of these lately things. The team that might as well be in the SEC the way we play them, which is Clemson.
I don't want to play them again.
No, I'm so sick of Clemson. I couldn't care less about Clemson. The non-SEC team probably that I've enjoyed beating the most the last few years when we beat Penn State. That was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to play Wisconsin again. And you realize if we get bumped out, we're going to talk about bowls. If we get bumped out of the Sugar, we might end up playing Wisconsin in the Capital One again. It'd be third time in our last probably 12 bowl games. So, but yeah, what non-SEC team have you enjoyed beating?
I mean, I enjoyed
Oregon.
I was going to say that's the obvious answer, but. I enjoyed when we beat Virginia Tech in the Sugar Bowl in 2004. Yeah. I mean, I live in Virginia, so I appreciated that one.
There you go.
And I enjoyed when we beat UVA in the Chick-fil-A game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wish we could catch Oklahoma or Notre Dame one of these days.
Yeah, only in a bowl game. I mean, we're not going to schedule those. Well, although we do play at Kansas State next year.
That's going to be awesome. I'm going to that. I'm totally going to that. It's not that far from here, really, relatively speaking. We've played Texas a lot, and we've played Florida State a lot, but both in the regular season, except for one Florida State bowl. That was pretty neat. I do like beating Florida State. There's no doubt about that.
Yep. All right. Let's talk some more about the Georgia game.
All right.
The first thing was how well Auburn came out playing.
Yes, man.
At such a high level. I mean, Georgia is a good team. Coming into that game, they were third in the SEC in run defense, 20th overall in the country.
Not anymore.
And we gouged them. Huge drives up and down the field. Great running game in the first half.
Oh, the happiest I was in this game was when we got the ball away from them and we started punching it. And we went tempo. And they were just clueless. And we went bang, 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 touchdown.
Yep.
I was just looking at my wife and saying, this is why I love this offense and this coach and this style of play so much. Nobody does it. Maybe Oregon, you know, whatever. But that is just so – even they don't do it quite the way we do in terms of power running, you know.
Yep.
Just like not only are we blowing doors down the field, but we're not doing it by scampering around you as much as just punching you in the face 15, you know, 7 or 8 times.
And the same play over and over again sometimes.
Oh, just – sticking it to them, absolutely.
And we had talked during the season about the lack of tempo thing, but I think they brought it out some in this game.
Yeah.
And there were times in the game when they really picked up the pace.
Well, there's no doubt that Gus has figured out when he wants to do it now, and it's when things start swinging our way and he feels like he can get a score.
Mm-hmm.
He'll slow it down when he needs to, but when he feels like there's blood in the water and things are going our way, he's like, stomp it now, stomp it now, go, go, go.
Yep. All right, and then the other big question in the coming into this game was, could Auburn throw the football? And I think the answer, you know, outside of the fourth quarter and the passing play at the end, the answer was yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we see there is Auburn's running game is so dominant that teams have to respect it, and they have to be worried about it, and they have to play it first. So you see the linebackers and the safeties – you know, watching for the run keys the whole time, and it opens up stuff in the passing game, and Auburn took advantage of it.
Nothing away from Nick Marshall. And as Gus likes to point out, he didn't even go through spring. So everything he's done has been above expectations to a large degree, right? I mean, remember at the beginning of the season, we were worried he was going to throw more interceptions than touchdowns and get benched. But that being said, with the running game that we have and what you just talked about, How successful would a real passing quarterback be in this offense with them having to respect the run the way they do? Because honestly, he does miss a lot of his.
He does, but one of the things that makes the offense so dangerous right now is his running.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I mean, remember that the offense took off at the Ole Miss game when he started running, keeping it on the read option and making big plays.
Yeah.
And that's when really the offense took off to another level. And that the fear of him, you know, creates a situation where the defense can't stop everything. I mean, they can't focus on the inside and worry about Mason. They can't focus on the outside, worry about the sweep, and then worry about him and bother to cover the receiver. So, you know, you end up with kind of a pick your poison thing, and Auburn just has to, you know, take advantage of what the defense is doing, and one of those plays will be there.
Well, let's point out that we talked about that a little bit in the you ended up writing our column this week because I was still sick until this morning, but I did send you some photos I had captured off of the game, and so we talk about that a little bit about what's really, I think, remarkable about the performance of Marshall in the running game was that they did as well as they did considering how Georgia had defended it. And I show in a couple of pictures how they had at least two defenders basically on the edge waiting for Marshall to run outside.
Mm-hmm.
And even still, he had some plays where he got through them and got 10 or 15 yards or something.
I have to say my favorite play of the entire game was the play where he kept the ball and ran through about six Georgia defenders.
Hey, yeah.
I was literally laughing at the TV when that happened.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That was my favorite.
Yeah, they had him, and he just squirted out and kept going. That was amazing.
And we did have the one Jeremy Johnson appearance for pass, one for one, 14
yards. I know. I was thinking, hey, look, it's the Sasquatch. Every now and then he comes out of his cave and throws the ball, and then he goes back in. And it was a good pass.
It was. Right on target.
Yeah. But you can't bring him in the fourth quarter, though, can you, in that circumstance?
No. No, good gosh.
Oh, man. And it's tough. So. Oh, by the way, hey, did you see that we have redshirted Justin Garrett?
I did see that.
Isn't that interesting?
And it is. And, hey, we could use him next year.
Yeah.
We could have used him this year, so he'll help next
That's
year.
That's a truth. Him and Therese out there at the same time would have been nice if they were both up to speed.
So Auburn had 566 total yards in this game on 84 plays.
Mm.
And I think I read today it was the most yards Georgia's given up since – I've got to go back. I can't remember the year now, but it's a long time.
Wow.
A long time.
We have,
like 20 years.
We have an offense, don't we?
We do. I mean, the Auburn – it's not, you know, bad defenses. It's not some kind of gimmicky thing. Our offense is one of the five or six best offenses in the entire country. It's a force.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting better all the time. I mean, this was a real legitimate SEC defense that a lot of people thought would shut down the offense. And we had almost 600 yards and over 40 points against
that them. Is what is so amazing about Gus and his system. This is a team that couldn't get out of its own way last year, that struggled to win three. That was, to be honest, we're fortunate to win three games.
Yep.
And with the same players, except Corey LeMonnier, basically.
Yep. And Marshall.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and you add him, right. I was going to say, and Cameron Artis Payne, but, well, so much for that. So, I mean, how did, you know, he came in 2009 from a team that couldn't trip over its own feet on offense and turned us into a team that looked so good and set, you know, offensive records, the 2009 team. It's just, and of course, 2010, good Lord. So, I mean, you got to give him his due.
Yep. He's excellent.
He takes chicken poop and makes the best chicken salad you've ever seen.
That's
not
right.
To say that what we had was chicken poop, but I mean, the production.
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Another big part of this game was defensive line made some plays. D Ford had a great game.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably his best game in Auburn. He's had some other games where he's got some big sacks and stuff.
Until they held him, started chopping him and cutting him and injured him. And then after that is when they scored all three of their fourth quarter touchdowns. It was right after that, but, you know.
When he was out of the game a lot. You're right. But they were also going a lot quicker passes where it didn't give him time to get there. One of the other things that really happened in the game that helped D Ford was the crowd. I mean, it was so – you could see it on TV. It was so loud in there
mm-hmm.
that the Georgia tackles couldn't hear Murray, and they couldn't start, you know, when he was doing the snap count. So sometimes they were having to watch the ball just like the defense, and that's a huge advantage for the defense.
Yeah, they started a lot of series first and 15.
Yep. A lot of penalties on them, and that was a big – the crowd gets all the credit for that.
Oh, yeah.
They influenced the game.
Absolutely.
We did want to talk about a couple of the new things that Auburn did in this game offensively. The one play that you really loved is when, you know, Marshall kind of fakes the inside run, and then they fake the end around, and then he turns around and has like a run-pass option where the receiver standing on the sideline, he runs towards him and threw the ball.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if he ever actually threw it.
He did. There was one where he threw it to Lewis, and it worked.
But he's definitely – yeah. Well, he definitely showed it, though. He'd raised the ball up, and you could see he was aiming like he was going to. And, you know, even just the threat would freeze the defenders in certain spots and give him a step. You know, so
and then he had the option to turn up field.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So, and I understand that we sort of borrowed that from Oregon. I mean, I think it's neat that, that a number of things that we do, all the way down to the play calling cards, we've kind of borrowed from Oregon over the last couple of years. I mean, heck yeah, if you know, in the offense that we run, why not throw some stuff that they do in there because it certainly works for them. I have no problem.
Well, and
with that.
It's stuff like that. If it works, use it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't have any problems with that. We also had a discussion last week about kind of a prop bet question, and it was which would have more of in the game, Jeremy Johnson passes or Cameron Artis Payne runs.
Well,
and we said Cameron Artis Payne runs, but that did not happen. Jeremy Johnson had one pass attempt, one completion, and Cameron Artis Payne had zero carries.
I will posit this to you. If we had not let them come back, if it had been 37-17 in the last 5 minutes, we would have seen Cameron Artis Payne. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree.
So this once again, situationally. But what I don't understand is, for all that we love Trey Mason, I just don't understand why you don't mix him in a little bit or have them both on the field at the same time or something. What do you think's going on? We ask this every week.
Well, here's how the carries broke out. Are you ready? Mm-hmm. Trey Mason had 27 carries for 115 yards. Marshall had 19 carries. That includes some sacks. Ricardo Lewis had 5 carries for 66 yards. Mm. And Grant had 6 carries for 53 yards.
Yeah, we started using
Lewis.
Yeah, we started using Lewis on kind of the sweep, just like Grant, which is an interesting little thing. You know what's interesting? I was counting the runs in the first half. How many carries did Trey Mason have in the entire game?
27.
How many did he have in the first quarter? Do you have it broken down? I can tell you.
No, I don't have it by quarter.
I can tell you. He had
15?
10.
Okay.
How many did he have in the second quarter? 10. So he had 7 carries in the second half, and one of those was the collision. So that means there were 6 offensive plays by Auburn in the entire second half where Trey Mason carried the ball for more than half a step. What, I mean, we know what was going on in like the last 7 or 8 minutes of the fourth quarter, but what happened in the third quarter, do you suppose, that had him down to just 4 or 5 carries during all that time?
That's an excellent question. Again, we should have been feeding him the ball. I don't understand.
I'm going to have to go back and watch the second half again and just get and just track the offense and see, you know, hey, I've got a week now that I can do it. I've got nothing else.
All right, so let's move on and talk about some bowl game scenarios.
All right, let's do it.
Now, the way I think about this is kind of 3 options. If Auburn loses to Alabama, what bowl do we go to? If Auburn beats Alabama but then loses in the SEC championship game, what bowl do we go to? And then if Auburn beats Alabama and wins the SEC championship game.
All right, I think that's an excellent way to look at it, but let me preliminarily say this. I think that all the bowl experts – have been fundamentally flawed in their predictions because it's to the point now that I was actually talking on Twitter with Brandon Marcello, the beat writer, one of the beat writers for Auburn, about this week. I was saying, you know, I think that this is getting a little blown out of proportion that all these people think Auburn's going to the Sugar Bowl because I said, you know, if we beat Alabama, then it gets really complicated, right? Because then we're in Atlanta and there's a number of variables. But I said, if we lose to Alabama, people have us in the Sugar Bowl. We'll be 10-2. Well, Texas A&M could very well be 10-2. We will have lost more recently than them, and they have Johnny Football, right? So there's every possibility that A&M could be higher ranked than Auburn after the Iron Bowl if the unthinkable happens. Or even if they're not, they could still pick them because they don't have to go by ranking.
But let's do this then. Let's go through who is Auburn contending with for a bowl spot.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
Texas A&M is the first team you mentioned.
Yes.
They play LSU this weekend.
Yes. Huge,
and then they play
huge game.
Huge game. And they play at Missouri the week after that.
Another huge game. Yeah, A&M basically gets to help decide the top of each division.
Right. But here's the problem with LSU game. LSU could finish 10-2.
No, they got three losses already.
Georgia, Alabama, Ole Miss. You're right. They got three
so
losses.
We don't
so they
have
could
to,
be 9
we don't
and 3
have to worry times. About LSU. They're in the bottom. They're done.
The other scenario, the other team that could finish up there is Missouri.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to worry about A&M in the short term stealing our bowl. And then if things bounce a certain way, we have to worry about Missouri stealing our bowl. Because if Missouri goes, let's say that Alabama beats us and then Alabama beats Missouri. Alabama's in the BCS championship, but you've got a two-loss Missouri with I guess, one more win than we have, because they'd be 11-2 and we'd be 10-2. So then Missouri could end up in the Sugar Bowl ahead of us. So we basically need, and you and me and your brother talked about this week, and he laid it out very succinctly. He said we need for A&M to lose to LSU this weekend and then beat Missouri, because that eliminates both of them a peg down from us.
Yes.
So if you're an Auburn fan, you want to know how to root the next two weekends, root for LSU on Saturday and then root for A&M over Missouri.
Because the other thing that does is it brings South Carolina into the championship.
It does. And then you got a two-loss Carolina that if they beat Alabama or whoever.
Well, but it's a two-loss Carolina team that whoever is going to lose to whoever comes out of the West, us or Alabama.
Yeah, well, that's
– I mean, either one of those teams is going to beat South Carolina.
Yeah, that's true.
And then they would have three losses.
Yeah, you're right. So, yeah, so if Alabama beats South Carolina, they're out of it. South Carolina's down in the Capital One or something. They may drop.
That's right.
In fact, you know, one of the scenarios that's really fascinating is if certain things happen leading into the championship game, the whole SEC could get knocked down so many pegs that you could have SEC teams with two losses or three losses down in like the littlest bowls, the littlest SEC bowls. It could be one of those years where you have a whole bunch of SEC teams with only two or three losses, and they're scattered down in the lower bowls just because there's a crush of them.
You're right.
So, I mean, that's happened a few times in the past. I mean, one time when it happened, do you remember this? One time that it happened, Ole Miss was 7-4, and there was no bowl for them. They didn't get to go to a bowl game. I mean, that's pretty sad. SEC team finishes 7-4 and doesn't even get invited to a bowl. Because there was no space for them.
I don't think that's going to happen this year.
I'm just saying you're going to have a team that's like 9-3 or 10-2 playing in like the Outback Bowl or the Chick-fil-A Bowl or something.
That's right. That's going to happen. I don't think that's a terrible thing, but that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So we talked about what the other teams need to do. I think if Auburn loses to Alabama, I do think the Sugar Bowl is a real possibility. It should be 10-2. If Alabama beats us, they're going to beat whoever comes out of the East to go to the national championship game. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a second SEC team in the BCS bowls, and it will be between Auburn, Texas A&M, South Carolina, Missouri. Those are kind of the other potential teams.
Well, remember, Texas A&M and Missouri play each other, right?
Right. So one of them
will knock
loss.
The other one out. Right. He'll be one fewer. We just don't know which one.
Right. So it'll be one of them.
Yeah.
Theoretically, potentially South Carolina or LSU, us or Texas A&M. So those are kind of the four teams that could be there. If we lose to Alabama, I think Alabama goes and crushes whoever comes out of the East. Mm-hmm. I think we'll be I really think it's going to happen. I think we're going to get the Sugar Bowl berth. If we beat Alabama and lose to the SEC in the SEC championship game, I think we could get a worse bowl.
Yeah, that's like the worst case scenario in a way. At least, I mean, I'd rather beat Alabama even if everything else goes bad.
Well, I agree. I'd rather beat Alabama and be in the poinsettia bowl.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not for a second would I change.
But that being said, if we're talking about bowls, that is kind of the worst case scenario bowl wise, because then you've put, by us beating Alabama, if we don't get in the BCS bowl, we're still only, quote unquote, only in the Sugar as SEC champions, and you knock every other SEC team down one.
Well, we still might get two SEC teams. They could take an at-large team in another BCS bowl, like the Orange Bowl or the Fiesta Bowl or something.
Yeah.
And they could take Texas A&M in one of those or something. But what happens then is, you know, they might take Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, if Auburn goes to the SEC championship game and loses,
yeah,
then I think we end up in the Capital One Bowl.
Yeah, because we would have
the team that beat us gets the automatic bid and we'll go to the Sugar Bowl.
Right, and then everything gets knocked down a spot, yeah.
Right, and then Alabama's sitting there at 11-1 or whatever, they could take them as an at-large in another bowl.
Yeah.
So I think that's the from a bowl perspective, that's probably the worst case. You know, if we win, then we're going to go to the Sugar Bowl at the least. Mm-hmm. There is an outside chance, I don't even like to say this, no, that Auburn could go to the national championship game.
Yeah, but that's
– I'm not holding my breath about that.
There's too many undefeated teams is my thinking. I mean, you know, and I would just love it so much if Urban Meyer gets, by the way, goes undefeated and gets left out, because it wouldn't be the first time it happened to him. You know, he had it happen to him at Utah. Yeah.
But, I mean, so we'll know how realistic that discussion is a week from now, because Baylor plays at Oklahoma State on Saturday. And that's by far their toughest game left. And if they lose, then there's only three undefeated teams left. And Ohio State still has to play Michigan and probably Michigan State in the championship game. And it's possible they could lose one of those. Florida State's not going to lose.
No.
So.
Yeah, it's more likely Alabama will lose than Florida State will lose.
Well, again, we could take care of Alabama.
Right, exactly.
So the issue is somebody else has to lose for Auburn to get there.
Yeah.
All right. I think we've kind of beaten the bowl topic to death there.
root against Texas A&M, because if we do somehow lose to Alabama, A&M becomes our main threat and we need them out of the way. There you go.
Right. If they beat both LSU and Missouri
and we lose to Alabama,
they'll have the same record,
but they'll be the hot team.
They'll have two wins over top, you know, 15 teams at the end of the season, and they'll have, you know, Johnny Manziel, and bowl games will go after them. All right. We're not going to talk a lot about Alabama this week. We got a whole other podcast to do nothing but talk about the Alabama game next week.
Did you see the window of the Georgia cafeteria or whatever?
Mm-mm.
On campus? They had, I think Jeremy had it up on the War Eagle Reader this week. It's like, you know, they've been writing in paint on the window, the score.
Mm-hmm.
And even the losses, they were, you know, the Vanderbilt loss, they had it dutifully written in. And for the game, for the Auburn game, it said no in one score, and the other score, it said don't even want to talk about it on the window.
That's good.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, Georgia's obviously going to win that. But I wonder if they'll have any kind of a hangover and be, you know, like listless.
I absolutely think they're going to have a hangover.
Man. I know we would. Can you imagine if we'd had to go – what if we hadn't had the immaculate deflection and then immediately had to play Alabama?
It'd be bad.
Oh.
Very bad.
Yeah.
And even having gotten the immaculate deflection,
yeah,
I'm so glad we have a bye week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the emotion and everything. They had to be drained.
Yep.
I mean, at the time, they were ecstatic, but by, like, Tuesday, you had to think they were just like, ugh. So
that's right.
Absolutely. Well,
all right. Another fun show this week.
Yeah.
Looking forward to talking a lot about Alabama next week.
Oh yeah.
And glad we had the roller coaster. We had the whole time to recover from it and put it in perspective, talk about it this week. We hope you enjoyed it, and we certainly had fun talking about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bring your hate next week, because we're gonna, as how'd you put, the hate that keeps us warm was your famous line from our book.
It's like that kid in Red Dawn, yeah, when they're out in the wood, they're in the mountains and the Rockies, and they're fighting against the, you know, the Soviet Union and the Cubans who have occupied America. And there's this old fighter pilot who's talking to this kid, and he said, "Kid, you're gonna get cold out there." And he goes, "My hate keeps me warm."
And that's how we feel about the red team.
That's right.
Tennessee was called.
All right. Well, this is really fun, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that. Before we go, we have to thank our patrons who keep shows like this on the air for us. For as little as $1 a month, you can be part of the AU Wishbone family and help us keep these shows going. Just go to www.auwishbone.com. We have to thank our usual cast of characters, as well as our newest arrivals, including Matthew Flowers, Carl Von Drunker, Samuel Salvatore, and Christopher Burleson, plus Phil Amthor, Ben Spooner, Bart Lindsay, Bradley Blackman, William Glenn Matthews, Gary Grant, Brian Gray, Willie Carden, Tom Anderson, Susan Trawick, Logan Chilton, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Steve Trawick, and Richard Stevens. And then we have William William Morgan, Johnny Caldwell, Emmanuel Seaman, W.D.E. Ritchie, Winston Boddy, Clinton and Christopher Stewart, Mickey B., Phil Davis, Joshua Corbett, John Otsuki, Preston Settle, Daniel Odom, A.U. Falling Up, Alchemist, Kevin Smith, Clarence Alford, Will Summerford, David Hegler, Theodore Geary, Reynolds Wolf, Joel Beckham, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, John McCune, David Evers, Timothy Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, and Rich Reimer. And then we have Chris Hilton, Sarah Hines, Darris Benton. Hey, welcome to some new folks there. Rob Morgan, Blake Heron, Hugh Anderson, Stephen Houston, Cato the Barner, Danny Flack, Papa Todd, Russell Milling, Kevin Kenoy, Don Zederman, Ross, Lane Middleton, Shannon Butson, Randall Walker, Shane Bailey, Chris Thrash, Tony Perry, Alex Wynn, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, and C.T. Wayne. And finally, we have Jeremy Minton, Wardam Wade, Spanky, J.W. Rice, Jason Albrick, Mick Vigicana, Russell Souther, Paul Bankson, Joseph Iliff, Justin Bean, Kevin Mahan, Stephen Wyatt, Trevor Johnson, Auburn Elvis, Robert Drain, Brandon Smith, Royce Alvarez, Thomas Brinson, David Smiley, Matthew Wagstaff, Donnie Reynolds, Wade Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, Darren Pyle, Chris Camo, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Raines, Nicholas Craig, Joseph Miller, that's Joey Miller to you, Mark Squire, Chris Brent Rumble, plus our one-time and anonymous donors. We thank you all so much, and just go to www.auwishbone.com. And now we're going to get on out of here for another episode. My time is up. I thank you for yours. War Eagle, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the AU Wishbone. Find links to everything we do at www.auwishbone.com. For more Auburn fun, join us on Twitter at @AUWishbone and at facebook.com/AUWishbone. War Eagle.
The AU Wishbone is produced by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer. Copyright 2020.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Thank you for listening to the AU Wishbone Podcast.